Stefano, and this is Nightside on 720 WGN. It's great to be here with you, and it's great to have Casera in the producer's box, and I've got my trusty engineer here. Thanks for helping me out tonight. Give me a shout out. I love it. Okay, my engineer is hitting all the right buttons at the right time. So hold on to your bootstraps, everybody, because I have got a great show for you. I'm going to be here with you until 1 a.m. And my first guest is really a powerhouse in her own right. She is the founder of the National Vegetarian Museum. And this is what I love about Chicago, because you think of Chicago's history and you say, well, that's a meat eating town. And it is. And of course, we know its long history of the stockyards. All you need remember is that book, The Jungle, by Upton Sinclair. So long history of eating meat in Chicago and shipping the animals in with trains and, of course, slaughtering them here in the city. So I would never think that Chicago had a vegetarian history, let alone a vegetarian museum. But in fact, we do have a vegetarian museum, and the founder of that museum is in the house. Kay Stefkin, come on over to the microphone. She's just arriving into the studio. Come on over to the microphone, and I'd love to hear about the National Vegetarian Museum. And Kay, you can speak right into that microphone there.
Okay.
So wonderful to have you here in the studio with me.
Thanks for inviting me, Elizabeth.
Okay, so Kay, set me straight here. When I think of Chicago, I do not think of any vegetarian history. Is there such a thing in Chicago?
Not only do we have a long vegetarian history, but actually back in our history started in the mid-1800s. By the late 1800s, Chicago was the epicenter of vegetarianism in the country.
Okay, wait. So at the same time that it's the epicenter of meat slaughtering, animal slaughtering, it's the epicenter of vegetarianism.
Yes, yes.
That is so Chicago. We're doing it all. Like, we don't want to let anything go. We're doing it all. So when did you decide to start the National Vegetarian Museum, and how did you start it? Because I think I understand that you did it all by yourself.
And it happened overnight. About 5 years ago, Michael James, who was the owner of Heartland Cafe, invited me to be on his radio show, live from the Heartland, to talk about Chicago's vegetarian history, which I thought I knew. So I went on the show, and we talked about our history, which I thought started when I opened the bread shop in 1971. After that show, I got calls from a number of organizations to speak for their organization. And so I decided to go on the internet, go to the library. I had done no research for the Heartland show. And I decided to see maybe there's something I don't know about it. And I was really stunned to find out that Chicago had a history going back to the 1800s. I was shocked. I had heard nothing about this in all my years of vegetarianism. And I figured that if I didn't know we had this history, neither did anyone else. And I think it's important that people know this. I think that it will make our great movement even stronger to know that you have a history, and you don't have to repeat the mistakes of the past. You have other people's knowledge you can learn from, and you're part of something bigger than yourself. I think it will go a long way towards strengthening us.
So walk me through what actually happened in the 1800s. So when you say that Chicago was the epicenter of vegetarianism, were there restaurants, or did they just have town meetings, or what was it like for them?
We had an organization called the Chicago Vegetarian Society. Now, I had joined it in about 1990, but that was the third incarnation of it, which I didn't know, and which the founder of it didn't know. So there was a Chicago Vegetarian Society. There were a number of restaurants, vegetarian restaurants, in the middle of the loop. Our first restaurant opened in 1900. It was called the Pure Food Lunchroom. It was on East Madison Street.
Wow.
I think what really brought it together in Chicago was that we had a very large presence at the Columbian Exposition, a World's Fair.
In 1893.
Yes, 1893. We had a very big exhibit, and I think with that is when the epicenter moved from the East Coast to Chicago.
And so did they give out pamphlets? Were they trying to talk to other people about this? Or were they solely concerned with themselves and their health? Or were they concerned about the animals? What really brought them together?
I think it started with health. I think animals was a lesser issue. From what I've read, one of the things that weakened the vegetarian movement is that they started to get involved in other types of issues.
So they lost their focus.
They lost their focus.
I see.
Yeah.
What kind of issues? Like politics and things like
that?
Yeah,
not bad issues, but things that...
More than they could take on.
Yeah.
Wow, it's fascinating to me because I think I read somewhere that not only did we have this vegetarian society and we were sort of the epicenter, but we were the first city that had the Vegetarian Times. And so we have a publishing history as well for vegetarianism.
Yeah. Paul Obus started the Vegetarian Times. He was the editor. He created it. And he lived in Chicago. I remember that he delivered his first copies on a bicycle in Chicago.
Of course he did. Of course he did, because he's a Chicagoan. So of course he did. And I think I read somewhere that it, you know, now today it's a glossy magazine. It's, you know,
it
really
actually
lovely,
just, but... yeah, just recently went defunct.
Right.
But still has an online presence, I believe.
But for the longest time, it was really sort of forward for magazines in this genre. But when it started, it was just a little leaflet, right?
Yes, it was like a 4-page handout. And I think within the first year or so, it turned into a magazine.
Okay, well, we have so much more to talk about. We're going to go to a quick break, and then I'll be right back with Kay Stepkin, founder of the National Vegetarian Museum. Nightside. I'm Elizabeth Alfano on 720 WGN. In the studio with me is Kay Stepkin. She's the founder of the National Vegetarian Museum. Yep, folks, we've got one. And it's not just that we have one. We have one for the entire nation. Kay, this is the only museum like it in the whole country, right?
It is the only one in the country. I imagine it's the only one in the world because I've gotten so many emails now from around the world and nobody has mentioned that they've heard of another vegetarian museum.
I love this, Kay. You are a force to be reckoned with. Tell me how you started this museum all by yourself and what it is exactly.
The museum, it is a traveling exhibit. It consists of 12 panels about 3 feet wide by 7 feet tall. We also have a video narrated by Victoria Moran with about a 5 or 10 minute history of vegetarianism. So when you go to a museum, it's not like you're sitting down and reading a book. So we can't have that much information. We have to keep it snappy, interesting. We have facts mixed up with jokes and some visuals, some interactives, where we ask a question and people can answer it, and we keep it interesting.
So I walked through the museum myself, and I have to say I was so impressed because you have a national kind of history of vegetarianism, then you have Chicago's history,
yes,
then you have an international history, and then you have some of the politics behind it, and then we talked about the Vegetarian Times, so some of the publications that came out, some very important books about vegetarianism, and then you have things like, as you say, jokes and recipes. So just in case you want to know this, people, Alicia Silverstone has a kick-butt chocolate peanut butter cup recipe, and it's to die for. So you can get that, if nothing else, at the National Vegetarian Museum. So now it's a traveling exhibit. Tell me what you mean by this.
We move around Chicago. We go to a different venue every 1 to 2 months. We have professionals transporting it for us. First of all, we didn't have a permanent location. I started out looking for a permanent location, and it just got so incredibly complicated. I think I wound up deciding we'd be in Andersonville because the rent was right, and yet it was still along the lake, and there's still diverse communities of people living along there. And then I realized, well, how we wanted to keep the museum free. Well, how are we going to pay the rent? Well, then I thought, well, I know how to run a bakery, so maybe we'll have an adjacent bakery providing the money that's going to support the museum. It got so incredibly complicated. I actually had gotten to the point where I was interviewing people to run the bakery, and then I realized, you know, I could find the most perfect person to run this business that's supporting the museum, and he or she could decide to move to California and give me 24 hours notice. And then one day I stopped into the Edgewater Library on, I believe it's on Broadway, and they had a traveling exhibit there. And as soon as I saw it, I knew, well, this would be perfect for us.
Don't you love how life works that way?
Yes.
You're just minding your own business, walking around, and then boom, you get this wonderful idea.
But you do have to be persistent.
Yes, no, you have to be dedicated, which you are. So now tell me, we're talking about the National Vegetarian Museum, and we're not talking about the National Vegan Museum. So it's kind of clarify that for me.
Okay, we do promote veganism. All of our the books that we recommend are vegan. The recipes are vegan. All of our events are vegan. We bring a program to each of our venues, and those are all vegan. But our history is vegetarian. Our history is not vegan. In fact, the word vegan wasn't even coined until 1944. But our history goes back to Pythagoras.
When you say our history, you mean Chicago history goes back to Chicago vegetarianism?
No, the world vegetarian history
goes back to Pythagoras,
yes,
the Greek philosopher.
Yes.
Yes, of course, which was around 500 B.C. Do I have that right?
B.C., yes,
okay.
It was.
Because, I could have gotten that wrong, so that was a lucky guess, folks. Yes, okay, so veganism didn't really come around until 1944, you say.
Yes.
And they decided that they would cut out meat. They would cut out eggs and dairy and cheese, which is dairy, obviously.
Yes.
And that's how they decided they would take
and
that out of their diet. And
they
be
being
vegan.
A man named Donald Watson from England, he coined the word vegan, and he created the Vegan Society, which is still in existence today, still thriving today.
Wow.
Which is quite thrilling.
So now Chicago has a really strong vegan movement as well. In
yes.
fact, I know at one point you'd mentioned, oh, I liked Andersonville because it had a lot of diversity. Mm-hmm. I think the oldest vegan restaurant in Chicago is on the South Side. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Soul Vegetarian, the original Soul Vegetarian, they're calling it now. It's actually the oldest vegan restaurant in the Midwest. And they now have it's on East 75th Street, and they now have two locations.
Okay, so
great food.
I went to this festival over the weekend called Chicago Vegan Mania.
Uh-huh.
And just for people who may be out there think like, oh my gosh, what would vegans eat? I've never eaten so much in my life. I'm still rolling from that event on Saturday. But I saw the Soul Food.
Oh, they had vegan. I had their macaroni and cheese there, yes.
I saw that they had a vegan gyros. And I was like, oh, I'm all about it, people. I am all about it. And I didn't, because I was eating so many other things, I didn't get to try it. But Soul Food Vegan, I'm all over it. That's on the South Side. I
yeah,
can't
original
wait to try
Soul
it.
Vegetarian.
Original Soul Vegetarian. Thanks for that. I really want to try that.
But they are vegan.
But they are vegan.
Yes.
Even though it's not in their
yes.
name. But they are.
Yes.
And they're the oldest in the city. I love that.
Yes.
Okay, but so I think when people think it's sometimes, so I'm vegan. And sometimes people come up to me and they say like, oh, those vegans, you know, they're always hugging trees and they're angry. And I just don't know anybody like that. I've never met anybody like that. I don't know anybody like that. In fact, I've always known people to be just really open about it and happy to try it and very happy about the difference that they're making for animals and the planet and the environment and their health. So I've never met any angry vegans. I'm wondering if you could tell me some of the celebrity vegans that we might know, that might everybody listening today might already know.
Okay,
their name.
There are celebrity vegans in every area. In politics, we have Al Gore, who came to it through his environmental work. Bill Clinton for a while was a vegan.
That's
I think
right.
he might have
yeah.
slipped up a little bit. I don't know if Dennis Kucinich is still in politics, but he is a vegan. He was a
Cory
representative.
Booker.
Cory Booker is another one. Yeah. For actors, you mentioned Alicia Silverstone. There's also Ariana Grande.
Oh, right.
Leon Helmsworth.
Yes, he's so cute.
Yes.
Jessica Chastain. Natalie Portman.
Natalie Portman.
Moby. Joaquin Phoenix. There's a long list.
There is. Yeah.
Albert Einstein. Sorry, I'm taking away the thunder. I'm just thinking in my head, like, yeah. all these people. Yes.
A lot of athletes, and I never remember their names because I don't watch that.
Tom Brady, football
Venus
star.
Venus Williams, wonderful. Is that her name? The tennis player? Mm-hmm. She's a vegan.
Yes, yes, so impactful. Yes, and you're seeing, it's funny that you mentioned vegan athletes, you're seeing more and more athletes take the medals and win the championships and go to the Olympics who are vegan. So it's a very exciting time, I think. I've heard a lot of them say that they feel they perform better on a vegan diet that is better for them.
I'm sure that's true because I feel so much better.
You feel so much better. Okay, so how can we find the museum? Because if it's traveling, I want to make sure people know how to get there.
We have a website, vegmuse.org, VEGMUSE.
And on the website, you'll say, okay, this month we're here, and next month we're there.
Oh, absolutely, yes. We have our venues for the next 3 months, the programs at each of those venues.
And do you do different events? Because it is traveling and you don't have your own space. Is it possible to have events there or food events or speakers, things like this?
There's some wonderful vegan documentaries. We've shown those. We have great speakers.
What do you have coming up?
This coming Saturday, Dr. Terry Mason is going to be our speaker at Woodson Library on the South Side. It's the central library in Chicago, regional. It's a regional South Side library. Dr. Mason, he's a great speaker. He's very dynamic. He's very interesting. And he happens to be the COO of Cook County Hospital and a vegan.
I love it.
Yeah.
And that's going to be this Saturday.
That's this coming Saturday. In November, we have Victoria Moran coming in from New York. She's also a wonderful speaker. She's going to address the spiritual aspects of veganism. Ought to be very interesting.
Okay, so if you're at all curious, and there's so many reasons to go, of course, there's the historical aspect. It's just fun to know in our fair, beautiful city of Chicago that we have vegan history as much as we have anything else. So if you're curious from the historical perspective, there's that. Or if you're curious yourself, thinking, well, maybe I'll try this, or I want to know more about it, or what are some of the benefits health-wise and otherwise, this museum exhibit
is
wonderful.
And we offer vegan food at every venue.
Well, then that's all there is to it, folks. Why else would you stay home when you could go get vegan food at the National Vegetarian Museum? I would like some vegan food. When are you having food events?
We always do it. At every program, we offer food.
I see. So if we go to the website and we find out where the exhibit is that month, we'll also see what events are happening that month and what food we can get. All right. Yeah. I'm all over it. Kay Stefkin, I want to thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
I know it's been a late night slot for you, but I appreciate you rolling up to the WGN microphone. Kay Stefkin is the founder of the National Vegetarian Museum. You can go to vegmuse.org to find out more. Oh, we've got the groove on tonight. I'm Elizabeth Alfano. It's great to be here with you hosting Nightside on 720 WGN. In the studio with me is vegan restaurant owner Mackenzie DeVito. Mackenzie, thanks for being here.
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
Great, thanks. Great to have you in the house. So let me get a handle on this. You're starting a restaurant in Chicago and you know nothing about the city. Is that right?
That's correct. I now know that we have a vegetarian museum in the city, so that's... We're moving up in the world.
So you have two restaurants called the No Bones Beach Club, and they're in Seattle and in Portland. And you and your husband have just moved here and decided to open a third restaurant, but you're just discovering the city. How did you choose Chicago? And then how did you choose where in Chicago you would open your restaurant?
Well, Chicago is a magnificent city. I think we all share that opinion here.
So wonderful.
I grew up in Michigan myself, and so I always vacationed to Chicago as I was growing up. I moved to Denver right after high school and spent many, many years there where I eventually met my husband. We moved to Seattle. We opened restaurant one. We opened restaurant two. And lucky for me, my husband and I decided we wanted to get back to a wonderful city in the Midwest, and we chose Chicago. We came here last October to the Vegan Mania Festival, And when we walked in, we were there to serve our jackfruit flautas, and we couldn't believe the line out the door around the building. And we were like, holy cow, there are vegans in Chicago.
Yeah, there's a market here.
This is where we're supposed to be.
It's fantastic. So, okay, when did you arrive in Chicago, and how have you found the reception so far to your food? Because I know that you've done some pop-ups trying to get people acclimated to the fact that you're coming to town.
Yeah, we did a couple of pop-ups through the winter, and then this summer we did the Vegandale Festival down at Grant Park. People are literally banging down the door of our restaurant. We are under construction, and it is not 10 times a day that there's not people being, when are you opening? When are you opening? So, I mean, we're just here. We're wrapping up a few last details. We're getting our staff in place. We're mixing up like the best cocktail menu ever. And we're just getting ready to sling it to all of the people of Chicago.
Oh, Max, ready to kill it.
I'm ready. Oh, yeah. Let's do this
thing. I love it. Let's do this. So tell me about your restaurant philosophy. What is No Bones all about? And what are you going to be serving?
Well, No Bones Beach Club is all about making vegan food accessible to everybody. You know, we don't say vegan on our menu a whole lot, but we have a really vibrant glam shack that is just packed full of fun decor, fun lights, banging music. We serve excellent, spicy, sweet, tangy food that's just delicious. It hits all of your different taste buds. We have a full bar where we do fresh cocktails made out of coconut milk. We use tequila, hibiscus. We use everything, anything and everything, all the vegetables. We are a vegetable-focused restaurant. You know, we think that we have everybody, food for everybody on our menu. We have buffalo cauliflower wings. We do our beer-battered avocado tacos that even my dad likes those, and he doesn't even eat vegetarian food.
Beer-battered avocado tacos? So you beer-batter the avocado?
Yeah.
How's that possible?
It's possible.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. We use gluten-free beer, too. So everybody with celiacs or gluten sensitivities, they can eat almost everything on our menu.
So I know when I was at Chicago Vegan Mania over the weekend, I stood in line. I was one of those crazy people standing in line for your food. And I had these delicious nachos. They were so spicy. And I kind of like it fiery, people. They were so spicy and good and filling. And then today at a pop-up, I had your corn dog. Yes, people. I had a vegan corn dog.
Elizabeth, you're not supposed to say we had that corn dog today.
Yikes. Well, I think the cat's out of the bag there. Uh-oh. We are on live radio. I'm sorry, everyone. I had a corn dog. I'm sorry. And it's a vegan corn dog, and it was good. I could have me some of that every day. So I don't know if you're willing to tell that secret recipe, but what is going on with that corn dog? It was off the charts.
Oh, my gosh. Jalapenos. We always start almost every recipe with jalapenos.
I love you.
Jalapenos, cornmeal, and we rolled it over a Beyond sausage. I don't know if you've had any of those tasty little treats.
Now I know. Now, okay.
Delicious.
That's the secret to life, is Beyond sausage.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'm actually amazed that you could get Beyond sausage, because every time I try to buy any Beyond meat product, I feel like I've been thwarted by the thousands who were there before me.
That's because I walked in right before you got there.
That's you. Oh, you are the ones. Okay. Now I see. I see who I'm up against. All right. I got it.
If you want some, though, I can probably get some for you.
You got an in for me?
I might.
All right. Well, so tell me about the process of opening a restaurant in Chicago, because I think of Chicago as a wonderful city that has lots of bureaucracy. So what is it like to open a restaurant? Do you need lots of permits and all that kind of stuff?
You know, you need the standard operating permits, and every city has them. You know, Chicago was actually fairly easy for us to work with. We had a great legal team help us through that process, and, you know, they made it easy. So,
okay, so you don't feel that it's too labor intensive or cumbersome to start? Because I think the thought of having a restaurant, to me, is so daunting when you think of all the staff and then all of the equipment that you need and then all the different food vendors. And then, of course, you are in a new city, so you're going to have to revamp your marketing strategy probably, or reach people and you're not even sure how to reach them yet because this is all new to you. And I just think like, oh, forget it. I'll just go order down the street.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot to do with that, but you know, our mission is to get vegan food to the people, so we're willing to do whatever it takes. We'll jump through any hoops needed in order to serve all of the people the vegan food that they so dearly want.
So let me talk to you a little bit about that. How important is it for you to bring vegan food to the people? So I know that there's a market, and I know that it's getting trendy, and there's sales to be had, and so there's definitely a business perspective, but how important is it for you to get that vegan food out there?
Well, I mean, I would say that is the No Bones philosophy, honestly, because our whole job is to make delicious food, make delicious drinks, and have it available. That's why we came to Chicago. That's why we're in Portland. You know, obviously we started in Seattle, but we want to be everywhere. We want people to know that, you know, hey, I'm trying out a vegan diet. I need to eat somewhere. Well, everybody needs to eat. So the idea behind being able to find a No Bones in either Chicago or the cities on the West Coast is that we're going to be there, we're going to be open, and we are, like, there to serve you.
How do you think you're going to handle three restaurants at the same time in different cities?
Flights? Status?
So you are going to do it yourself. You're not going to farm it out to have general managers that really do it all.
Okay. We have general managers. Yeah, we have an excellent team. I couldn't do this all by myself. I have an excellent management team with me here in Chicago, and then we have excellent managers in all the locations that help run the show, because I obviously can't be in three different cities at once.
Yes, no, you have taken on quite a bit. It's so exciting. And I think you told me that the restaurant is looking at an opening date, because you're still under construction, at around the end of November.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we're going to have to shout it out to the rooftops. Maybe I'll have you back on, or for sure on our blog site here, we'll be able to tell everybody that we're looking for the end of November.
Yep.
For the No Bones Beach Club. Okay, folks, we're going to hit a break, and then we'll be right back with the owner of the No Bones Beach Club, Mackenzie DeVito. I'm Elizabeth Alfano. It's 720 WGN. My producer, Casera, she's got the jams tonight. I love it. I'm Elizabeth Alfano, and it's Nightside on 720 WGN. Mackenzie DeVito is in the house. She's the owner of the No Bones Beach Club, a vegan restaurant that's about to open in Bucktown. So tell me, Mackenzie, can I call you Mac, or should I call you Mackenzie?
You can call me Mac.
All right, Mac. So tell me, how did you choose Bucktown?
Well, when we decided that we were going to make our moving into Chicago, we looked at some different restaurant spaces in all sorts of great neighborhoods, because Chicago is so rich with amazing neighborhoods. Mm. And our broker brought us to our current location that we're moving into in Wicker Park. And as soon as we got there, we knew that that was where we were going to land. I got off my flight coming into O'Hare, took the Blue Line in, walked down the steps at the Damon stop, round half of a corner, and then there was the restaurant spot. It was an amazing spot, right in the center of everything, right at the corner of Damon and North. You know, we could just tell by walking around the neighborhood, all of the different art and the people. It was such a vibrant neighborhood. And then, obviously, there were tons of people with dogs, and that's usually a key sign for a successful No Bones location.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You are in the thick of it right there, and it's a very eclectic corner, and it's that six-way corner, which is so great. So it's very vibrant. And when I think of No Bones, because I've been there, I've seen your space under construction, when I think of No Bones, I think of a lot of energy and music and people hanging out and community, and that's really what that sort of borderline Bucktown, Wicker Park area right there. That's really what that is. But, you know, you're also not too far in that area from a couple other vegan restaurants. And I wondered how you find the competition in Chicago, because veganism really is a strong trend. I don't want to say trend, because it's really a movement. I don't know if that's correct either, but there's a really strong group of people who are vegans, and it's become great business. So you have some competition there.
Yeah, you know, I've never looked at competition as a bad thing. In fact, if a vegan restaurant wants to move in next door to me, I would welcome that, because then I'd have somewhere else to eat lunch. I believe the majority of the vegan community supports one another, and I think we're all, anybody who is in the business and who is vegan wants more vegan. So I think collectively we all kind of come together as a community and support one another. Hopefully. That's my take on it. So
yeah, no, but I would agree with that. I've found the same in journalism, because I'm a plant-based expert and I do a lot of things for some public radio in Los Angeles and some digital magazines. And I just did a food demonstration, a vegan food demonstration on WCIU, the U. So, you know, I kind of get out with my plant-based message, and I find everyone to be really supportive. And I'm happy that you're saying you're finding the same thing with restaurants in Chicago.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of great restaurants that I like to eat at here personally, and I'll continue to be a customer, and hopefully we can all, like, you know, work at it together. You know, I think ultimately we want to serve the vegan food, so the more of it, the better.
Yeah, and I'd love to ask you, so your restaurants that are currently in Portland and Seattle, mm-hmm. have you found that non-vegans eat there?
Oh, yeah. Like so many.
So tell me all about that. Is it because they're testing it for the first time, or they're secretly addictive and they just don't want to mention that? Or
yeah, well, I'll tell you a little story about how we got started. I started with a food truck in 2014, and the original name of my food truck was called No Bones About It. So when we started, we would go out to these business parks and breweries and whatnot, and you know, the side of our truck said No Bones About It on it. So everyone would come up and be like, barbecue. Like, no, it's not barbecue.
You got that
it's
wrong.
Vegan. So, you know, sometimes if you're the only food truck there and it's a brewery and people have had a few too many IPAs out on the West Coast, you know, they want a snack. And turns out they loved our buffalo cauliflower wings. People would just freak out on how delicious all of our food was. And so it turns out we developed a lot of regulars to our food truck during that time. And then once we opened the restaurant in early 2016, you know, we had a line out the door for all of our carnivores coming to get our buffalo cauliflower wings. It was crazy.
And so do you ever talk to them and say like, hey, are you vegan at home? Or is this your one restaurant that this is your like secret addiction? Or you think they're slowly going vegan?
I think that they're slowly going vegan because, you know, you can tell how much they come to the restaurants. We have regulars that come 2, 3, 4 times a week, and they tell us, well, I'm not vegan. You know, there's a food writer who writes in Seattle, and he's a very good regular of ours, and he talks all the time about how he's not vegan, you know, but he writes for that magazine, and I know how much he comes in, and I think we're doing a number on him.
Well, it's amazing because there's so many great reasons. You know, I think a lot of people do it for their heart and their health. I know you and I are in it for the animals and also the environment, but a lot of people are thinking about this is a heart healthy choice, which makes a lot of sense. And sometime like a decade or two ago, because it was a long time ago now, people thought, ah, but if I make that choice, there's no good taste that comes with it. And that ship has just sailed. That's just totally wrong at this point.
I was going to say that was darn true 10 years ago.
Yeah. 10 years ago, it was newspaper for sure. It was like charbroiled newspaper.
It was so bad. Yeah. Now we have cheese.
Yes, right. Oh, and so much of it. Oh, my God. So my boyfriend actually makes vegan cheese.
Oh,
he makes
gosh.
It at home.
What?
Yeah, we have camembert. Yes, camembert
I've
vegan.
I've never even had that vegan.
I'm going to have him on my show. Yes, I am.
Can come to my house.
Okay, deal. We're doing that, people. And you all can come as well. All my listeners on WGN Radio, come to our house. We're making camembert vegan cheese. We're making blue vegan cheese. He makes a vegan feta. Oh, it's off the charts. It's up. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
He is. He's coming on the show. It's
all right.
True. You'll have to meet him. Well, okay. So how did you go vegan yourself?
Well, I went vegan originally as a diet because I was doing that health route originally. And then long story short, I met this little cat named Chloe. She's a little blue cat. She's still with me today.
It's a cat that turned you to the other side.
It's a cat. It was another cat named Reyes that started it. That was my husband's cat originally. And then just, you know, his love for animals just kind of rubbed off on me, and then before you knew it, we rescued, what, like 10, 12 cats. We're all vegan in our house. I don't even know what happened.
I'd love it. I love
it. It's been an adventure.
Okay, so do you ever get any flack for being vegan, or people who come up to you and they're like, well, this is just crazy. This makes no sense, or, you know, you must be like a tree hugger who eats bark. Right? I mean, those are just such crazy statements, but sometimes people come out with them.
I'm certainly not a tree hugger who loves bark, but I understand the...
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, I understand where people would get that idea with that big V word. I don't know. I think that I have an aura about me that says I'm not gonna take crap when it comes to talking about protecting animals. So,
oh, that's my Mac. Telling it like it is. Tell me that again.
I'm not gonna take crap for people treating animals like crap. I'm here for the animals, and I think you know, the food that you'll have at No Bones is gonna get you there too.
I love that. And really, I do want to stress this. So Mac and I are in it for the animals for sure, but you do not have to give up taste. You don't. And you don't have to give up convenience, and you don't have to pay a whole heck of a lot of money. So times have changed, people. So if you have any heart issues, or if you've read the UN environmental report, if you have any of these concerns that are basically headline news at this point, then, you know, you want to give No Bones Beach Club a try. So tell me again, when is this restaurant going to be open?
We are shooting for the end of November.
Okay, so we're going to look to find you the end of November. And how can people get this information. They might want to go to the soft opening. They might want to go to your party. They might just want to meet you because you do not take crap for animals, which we'd like. So how can people find out when the exact date is?
Well, you'll just have to keep an eye on our social media. So we are on Facebook at No Bones Beach Club, Chicago. We have a Chicago specific page, and you can find us on Instagram at No Bones Beach Club. We also have a newly published website at www.nobonesbeachclub.com. And all of the information, as soon as we have permanent dates, we will have everything up on those sites.
Okay, everybody, you've got your marching orders. You know what to do. Mackenzie DeVito, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
The midnight hour. I love it. Everybody, I'm Elizabeth Alfano, and it is Nightside here on 720 WGN. It's great to be in the studio with you. I have a fabulous guest with me. Stephanie Domingo is the Chicago director of Factory Farm Animal Coalition. And if you're saying, what the heck is that? Sit tight, folks. It's exactly what we're going to find out. Stephanie, thank you for being here with me.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, nice, nice. Well, I'm thrilled to have you in the studio because there's so much I want to ask you. I have so many questions, and it seems like a simple thing, like factory farm animals. Okay, how much is there to know about that? But I actually think there's a lot to know about. But let's start at the very basics. What do you do and why?
Yeah, so thank you. So, as you said, I'm the Chicago director for Factory Farming Awareness Coalition, FFAC for short, and this organization is a nonprofit that was founded by Katie Cantrell in 2010. And basically what we do is we go to high schools, colleges, companies, universities, and give presentations on the significant and negative effects of factory farming or industrial animal agriculture.
And who asks you to do that? Do you voluntarily find the schools and you go to them, or are they requesting this information?
Yeah, great question. So we do reach out to professors and teachers via, you know, public records of just having their emails and phones and such. But we do get a lot of professors and teachers who are really interested in having us come speak to their students in the classroom. So we never really have issues with having an audience to speak to. A lot of professors want their students to be educated on these issues. We cover a significant range of issues from environmental concerns to animal welfare to human health and workers' rights. So it's quite significant. It impacts us all.
And so you're speaking to elementary kids, high school kids, and college kids?
Mostly we're doing high schools is the most popular, and then we also do college and university students. But some of our directors, because there are a few of us nationally and also internationally, one in Canada, have spoken to elementary students and middle school students as well.
Okay, so when you go in, because it strikes me as sort of a young audience, but perhaps maybe this is the best time. I mean, they're there to learn, and this is a subject that oddly none of us really know much about. So what's the reaction of the kids?
Yes. So I sort of joke with the kids that I'm probably their least favorite person because I, you know, have 45 minutes, maybe to an hour to explain the significant impacts of this industry and how it impacts their lives and all of our lives. And basically, some of the kids are pretty shocked, and they're not really familiarized with this information in our society. Some of the kids seem to sort of maybe care less or sort of maybe doubt the validity of the facts that we're presenting. So everything that we present is source-based, and we have that all on our site. So, yeah, so we're just trying to educate people and empower them. So I guess the kids' reactions vary depending on the class and, of course, the individual and such. But for the most part, most all of the students are engaged and listening to me while I'm presenting. And, you know, consequently, every presentation after presentation, teachers and professors will tell me that they're shocked by how quiet the class was and how many students were paying attention. So I do have their attention, but then the reaction is varied.
So I really want to dive into this because I think what's fascinating to me is so many adults don't know about the repercussions of factory farms. I really won't even call them farms because it's just industry. It's industrial business. So let's start maybe from the basics. What are factory farms?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So factory farms are technically called CAFOs. That's the acronym. It stands for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. And basically, this is the practice of confining thousands, if not tens of thousands, of animals to quite usually dark sheds or large, facilities indoors. So confinement is sort of the hallmark of CAFOs or factory farming. And corporations are behind these CAFOs. So keep that in mind. So, these are had so that corporations can make the most profit for the most product.
Yes. And I think when people think of, let's say, milk or hamburgers or something, they think of the cartoon cow that is super happy. So something tells me that that's not actually the case if you're confined in a dark shed.
Yes, absolutely. So that's something we go over in our presentation. Normally, when you walk into the grocery stores, you see these pictures on products of, the rolling green hills and the happy cows and the chickens, and they have so much space and all the sun. But really, that's quite the opposite of the reality that they face. And a lot of consumers don't know that. And, very distant from our food. So this is part of the issue, and this is part of the reason why we're trying to spread awareness about what the majority of our food system is like. Factory farms make up about 99% of our food system. 99% of land animals are coming from factory farms in the U.S.
So let me just backtrack again a little bit. Back in the day, so to speak, there were small farms and animals moved around and people farmed maybe for their small community or maybe just their own family. And a farm really was just what we think it was. Animals sort of living together and supporting each other. So you'd have chickens and cows and pigs and maybe two or three of each. And there'd be this small ecosystem there. Is that what we're talking about when we talk about factory farms? I know you said tens of thousands and they're confined, but maybe you could explain it a little bit more, because I'm not sure if these things have white picket fences and outdoors, or if they are really cells.
Yeah, that's a great question. So normally these animals will be confined by species. So we might have 30,000 chickens that are being raised, for meat in the industry, and they were confined to these large industrial sheds. You'll see them. You can see aerial views of them nowadays, and they're these large, usually white colored sheds, and they're housing tens of thousands of chickens at a time, with not much space for them to move around. They're forced to stand in their own feces and things like that. So normally we have one type of animal, farmed animal, on each factory farm.
Okay. And what are the conditions like for these animals that are confined to this area? You mentioned they're maybe in their own feces, or I don't know, can they turn around, or they have no access to light? Walk me through some of these conditions.
Yeah, so it really depends on the animal. So for instance, egg-laying hens are pretty much about 90% of them in the U.S. are confined to what's called a battery cage. So they're these small cages where they really don't have room to spread their wings or walk around. They're confined with about 7 on average other hens. And we might have an industrial shed with, cages stacked row upon row and tens of thousands of these chickens. So obviously those conditions are very extreme and unnatural for these hens, and their bodies give out after about a year or two. And normally they could live about 8 to 10 years, just to give you an example. And then to give you an example of another farmed animal, pigs, for instance, specifically mother pigs, or what the industry terms breeding sows, are confined to what's called gestation crates. So, again, they're sort of cages where they don't have room to turn around or move around much, and they're constantly pregnant or nursing their piglets. Piglets are used and raised for pork. They're confined to these spaces for a few years until, again, their bodies are sort of spent. So these conditions are pretty unnatural and extreme for these animals. And, these animals, I like to remind people, are sentient, living creatures. And what I mean by sentient is that they can feel pain, joy, suffering. And they're also very intelligent and social animals as well. So this is very unnatural for them to be in these conditions.
I think one of the reasons that I became vegan is because I saw a video, and I think most people have seen a video at some point in their life of just horrific conditions, not just maybe abuse by workers on a farm or something like this, but either being shot or stabbed or really seriously horrible conditions. But I saw this one story of a mother pig, because pigs are so smart, and she was able to open the cage that she was confined in with her tongue. And then as soon as she did that, wow, she went to the cage to save her babies. And as soon as she did that, she then opened the cage of the other pigs so that they could get to their babies. They have extremely strong communities, and they're very smart. So when you wow think of animals like that, being without basic necessities of life, it's really hard to stomach. But I also think there's a natural disconnect.
Yes.
And the industry perhaps wants that. And I think kids exemplify this disconnect the best. Do you find in your school settings that some people don't know that Chicken McNuggets at one point were a chicken?
That, yeah, I'm really happy that you brought that up. And just to comment on your story, that's a really fascinating story that I haven't heard, and I'm so glad you shared with me.
Well, I'll share with you the video. I believe yes it comes from CompassionOverKilling.org, yes, but I can double check that. But wonderful, I'll share with you that video. It's gut-wrenching.
Yes, great. Thank you. Yes, so I apologize. What was the...
do you find that kids... I find that adults, so I'm guessing kids would as well, I'm finding that adults don't really recognize that this piece of yes meat was actually an animal. And sometimes they don't even know, like, a Chicken McNugget is actually from an animal and not just, like, processed
yes
batter.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, thank you. So, I mean, that was something I didn't know, honestly. I never thought about my food choices. You know, I grew up eating meat and dairy, eggs, my whole family did. It was just unquestioned. And I really never was forced to critically think about my choices or even was aware of what was going on or what our food system looked like. So, yeah, I don't ask kids specifically. I guess that's sort of an assumption that I make in the presentation, that they make this connection. But I really would not be surprised if some of the kids, you know, haven't made that outright connection, because I know I didn't until I was a certain age. And, you know, like you said, we're so distant from our food nowadays. We go into grocery stores and we see these products and they're in plastic packaging and such, but we don't see all of the history behind that product. We don't see these farmed animals, you know, slaughterhouses and factory farms aren't made of glass windows, and if they were, a whole lot would be different. So yeah, then nonetheless, you know, we're not, you know, many of us are not farmers and not experiencing these animals on a day-to-day basis and interacting with them. So I think because of this distance, it is causing a lot of unknowns to happen in this society, and then, you know, with this cruelty and other practices that people just aren't aware of.
And the problem with that is that when you have that disconnect, you can't make the choice for yourself because you're not informed, which is yes why I love what you do. We're going to run to break, but I just want to say before we get to that break, you might not think so because I'm vegan and we're having this conversation, but I have enormous respect for meat eaters. I'm going to leave you with that hanger right when we go to break, and I'll explain myself when I'm back. We're still jamming into the midnight hour. Thanks, Casera, for these jams. She's my producer tonight. I'm Elizabeth Alfano. It's Nightside on 720 WGN. Stephanie Domingo's in the house. She's the Chicago director of Factory Farm Animal Awareness Coalition. And we were talking about right before the break how much respect I have for meat eaters, because the fact is who, you know, we all grew up on meat and, you know, our folks did the best they could. And I mean, you know, a lot of people eat meat, and that makes a lot of sense because ultimately food is what brings us together, and food is where we congregate, and it's how family comes together, and it's our tradition. So I understand, you know, how we got to where we are. And, you know, I interviewed the CEO of Beyond Meat, who's just this wonderful guy, Ethan Brown. And he was saying, you know, it's our history, it's our culture. And I understand that. And now as we see, we're getting more information about how our food supply system is really working, and a lot of people are choosing to try something different. So that's what we're kind of talking about today. And you're saying basically you go into elementary schools, colleges, and mostly high schools to talk to students about factory farms. Okay. We've talked about the animals, but I'm wondering, what about the environment? How much of the environmental impact do you talk about with the kids that factory farms have on our communities?
Yes, absolutely. So this is a large facet of what we speak about in our presentations, and we have a specific presentation that touches on the environmental impacts. So again, I'm going to be the bearer of bad news, but there are significant environmental impacts that are being had because of industrial animal agriculture, including water and air pollution, land usage, deforestation, greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to climate change, which is really relevant given the United Nations IPCC report that just came out last week. But yeah, there's a whole slew of issues that stem from the environmental.
And is this something that the kids grab onto, or do they recognize it? I mean, you know, when you're 17, you think like, well, I'm never going to die, so it doesn't really matter how many hurricanes we have. And I certainly was that way when I was in high school. Is this something that resonates with them, or is it just a little bit too early?
You know, that's a great question. I think for high schoolers, maybe it resonates a little bit less than it does for college and university students, as I've seen. So I'm still newer and I'm still getting sort of the feel for things in the Chicago area of schools and students' reactions. But the college kids of all, you know, are aware of climate change and know what's going on. And the high schoolers seem to be aware, but maybe just less knowledgeable. And I mean, I know myself as a high schooler had pretty much no idea. I'm not afraid to admit, you know, what was going on and sort of the negative ramifications. So I think it's quite understandable, but that's exactly why what we're trying to do is just educate folks, and hopefully they can use that as empowerment.
So I understand it that the runoff of factory farms, so as you say, the deforestation of the land and then the emissions gases, creates much more environmental damage than planes, trains, buses, cars, all the transportation together. Is that right?
Yes. This is an astonishing fact. I was astonished to learn about it a few years back. So the United Nations had a report from the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, that stated animal agriculture actually accounts for more greenhouse gas emissions than the entire transportation section combined, what you said. So what's basically coming out of these animals, and I can explain more so now if that would be helpful, is worse than what's coming out of our cars. So, for instance, you know, we hear a lot about CO2 emissions, and we should talk about CO2 emissions and how they're contributing negatively to our climate, but we don't hear a lot about other very toxic, harmful greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide. So these animals naturally, and specifically cows, will emit methane via burping because of their digestive systems. And they will also fart and poop nitrous oxide. So methane is about 23 times worse for climate change than carbon dioxide is. And nitrous oxide is about 300 times worse. I think the number is 296 times worse, to be exact, than CO2 for climate change. So, I mean, remember, we have 9 billion land animals in the U.S. alone. So that's a lot of burping, farting, pooping land animals just in the U.S. And, you know, globally, that are contributing to climate change.
Well, so this is astounding for me to think about. I didn't realize it had anything to do with burping or any of that sort of stuff. But when you think of the billions, so we're 7 billion people on the planet. But give me the number again of how many billions of animals we eat a year?
Yeah, so this is the U.S. This is just in the U.S. every year. So it's 9 billion land animals. So that number doesn't even count fish or seafood that we eat, which is a whole nother astronomical, you know, number. So this is just one country, obviously.
Wow, that's an astounding number. But I think we all saw a little bit of that out of North Carolina. So it made big headline news when we saw that 4.1 million birds and 5,500 pigs were trapped in cages and left to drown intentionally because there's insurance that is to be claimed. And so there was no attempt to get any of those animals out. And when you saw those aerial pictures of those factories covered basically to the ceilings with water, I think it resonated with a lot of people. That's my food system at work. Mm. I just saw a lot of my friends who are meat eaters. It was really resonating with them that they didn't feel good about what they saw. I don't know if you've experienced that.
Yeah, definitely. This is something I talk to the students about when I go and present, because it's obviously a recent current event. And that's exactly right, that a lot of these animals ended up drowning. So, you know, part of the issue is that animals are seen as property under the law. So that will affect, you know, in turn, the way that they're treated. And this is a, you know, this is a structural societal issue. It's not just one person to blame or one, you know, farmer to blame, nothing like that. It's a structural issue. And I'm happy that you mentioned that, because that also brings in another environmental concern, which are these giant open air pits where actually the feces from, say, a pig farm, a hog farm is the industry terms in North Carolina, say they have about a couple thousand of these pig farms. The feces will get distributed into these giant open air pits, might be the size of maybe 4 football fields. And, you know, they'll sit there and such, and then eventually get sprayed out by these large garden hoses, essentially, in order to empty the pits to make room for more feces. It sounds bizarre is what I'm saying, but
it does sound bizarre.
Yes. But this is common practice. And actually, there were a few articles. I know the New York Times had one about it, about these lagoons basically flooding over. And, you know, when these stormwaters came in, those pits were affected, obviously.
Yes, and I think North Carolina is still, and my heart goes out to everyone in North Carolina, obviously, of
Absolutely.
Course. I think they're still grappling with the aftermath of the hurricane. It's just astounding how much damage happened. And as you say, then these pits were overflowing, and so then causing damage to the communities around. But I think one company, is Smithfield, just lost a $470 million lawsuit because of the damage that it caused its surrounding communities.
Yeah, so Smithfield is actually is featured in one of the videos we show featuring a pig farm in North Carolina. They're the largest pork producer in the world.
Yes, and I know that they just lost a lawsuit for $470 million, but it's not the first lawsuit by any means. There have been other companies as well who've had to pay the communities around them for the environmental damage that they cause to their water systems and to the land around. And there are also other repercussions. I think there's higher alcoholism and higher violence in the communities around factory farms. Is that right?
Yeah, so this definitely stems into workers' safety and health, specifically in slaughterhouse facilities. And one point that I always make sure to mention to the students as well is that communities of color and low-income communities are disproportionately affected by factory farms, as many factory farms are disproportionately placed in low-income communities, which are often communities of color. So, you know, as I said, they take the feces from this giant pit, this lagoon, and they spray it with these garden hoses. And often they are literally spraying this feces on these communities in order to get rid of it. So you'll hear accounts. You can look them up of people not being able to open their windows. And even such, the stench will come into their homes, or not being able to, you know, hang clothes outside or anything like that, because the stench will stick to their clothes because it's just so potent.
I know that any time I've driven by any of these factory farms, either in California or in Illinois, the stench is overwhelming. Mm. And it's someone was telling me that she lives by formerly Stockyards in Chicago. And even so, when she was a kid, it would be like in the water. And so when she would wash her hair, then it would smell like the stench that was in the air, which I think is so very, very creepy. Okay, we're going to go here to break. And then when we get back, we've got a couple other issues to talk about before we get into the real fun of it, about our food choices and what are some of the fun choices that we can make going forward. So, okay, folks, let's hit a break and we'll be back. So Kasara knows that I like disco. Yeah, this is planned out ahead of time, I see, because this is my kind of music, people. I am here, Elizabeth Alfano at Nightside, 720 WGN. Stephanie Domingo is in the house. She joins me from the Factory Farm Animal Awareness Coalition. We've been talking about lots of stuff. It's timely. What can you say? The UN climate change report just came out, so not much you can do except read it and sort of weep. We've been talking about some of the environmental damage from factory farms, but that's not the only thing that we're talking about. So, you know, of course we care about the animals, and of course we care about our environment, but obviously, we care about people. So what's it like for people who work in these factories?
Yes, absolutely. So slaughterhouse workers have one of the most dangerous jobs in the country, arguably. So, you know, it might be one person's job to, and, you know, I'm sorry for any gruesomeness, I won't get too gruesome, but, you know, to cut a certain body part of an animal, you know, for maybe a thousand times. And they might be doing that same motion, you know, a couple thousand times in one shift. So a lot of these workers will develop cumulative trauma injuries, just a fancy way to say repetitive stress injuries. They won't be able to do basic tasks when they get home at night. And, you know, in addition to it being really physically demanding, it's also very psychologically demanding. So a lot of these workers might develop PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the same mental illness our soldiers coming home from war experience. And, you know, this is because they're experiencing suffering and killing every day for their job, basically. So, you know, there are some other issues as well. I don't know if you want me to hold off on those or...
No, I think go right ahead, because I, you know, ultimately we want truth in the food system so that we can all make the best choices possible. And since we vote with our wallet, when you're at the grocery store and you're making a decision and you're putting your dollars behind that decision, you want to be able to make the most informed decision that you can make. And that's what you do by going into the schools and talking to kids, is to help them understand this is where your food comes from, this is what it does to your health, and these are the conditions for the animals and the surrounding communities and the workers. So ultimately we want to hear it.
Yes, okay, absolutely. So a lot of the times these workers will be ununionized, which means they have little job protections. They will also not have health insurance, let alone mental health insurance. And like I said, they might be experiencing PTSD from these working conditions. Additionally, these workers tend to be the most marginalized people in our society. So a lot of the workers might be are immigrants and might be undocumented or might be refugees coming in from other countries legally. I think a lot of citizens in the U.S. and people here, understandably, don't want to do this work. It's very dirty work. It's very grueling work. And so, you know, people who are in more desperate need of a job to feed their families are willing to take these jobs.
And because these are such violent jobs, basically, when it comes down to it, I understand that there's a lot more violence in the surrounding communities around factory farms, because when you're exposed to it, you know, it's not like you punch the clock at 5 o'clock and then you don't have this in your system anymore. So it sort of bleeds into your life beyond the job.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, a lot of these workers, like I said, are being exposed to violence and, you know, killing and suffering as part of their jobs every day. So they might resort to alcoholism or other forms of coping mechanisms, especially, you know, if they don't have access to mental health insurance or legal protections, job protections. So absolutely, it is a trickling effect into the communities and really does affect us all, and is something, you know, we should be concerned about, as, you know, we try to better the situation for all folks.
So it's amazing to me. Chicago is such a fascinating city. So in 1904, Upton Sinclair published The Jungle. And in The Jungle, he talked about the slaughterhouses of Chicago and other cities and what horrified people. And there was an outcry when they read this book, because of the inhumane standards for people and also because of the health issues for people in terms of the food safety. And so here we are more than 100 years later, and I'm not sure a whole heck of a lot has changed, except that Chicago currently only has 4 slaughterhouses. So certainly we don't butcher as much here in Chicago as that we used to, but you're still having horrible working conditions for the workers and then not necessarily a safe food supply. So it's interesting how much has changed and then how much has not changed.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually just reading an article that stated just that in Upton Sinclair's novel, you know, is about a protagonist that gets injured, because injuries are very, very common in these industries at a slaughterhouse and you know, sort of the ramifications of that. But, you know, the immigrants have always been a part of this industry, and they do this work, and then it was European immigrants, and now we are seeing it's, you know, that these are immigrants from Latin America and other countries. So absolutely, it's a trend we are still seeing today.
And I always think it's important because it's well documented that cruelty to animals usually translates to cruelty to people. So if you remember the Parkland shooting in Florida, that horrible, horrible shooting. So Nicholas Cruz, it was well documented. He put it on YouTube. He tortured animals on YouTube and he let the videos roll. We all had access to that and nobody really cared. And then later he, you know, did unspeakable things at that high school. And so he could have been arrested prior to what happened in the high school, and then that didn't happen. So I think there's a connection to be made between violence to animals and violence to humans, and that's why I think this is such an important topic, because, you know, ultimately we don't want a violent society. We want to open ourselves up to a more peaceful society if we can get there. So I think this is one great way to start.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we're trying to better our society, you know, for humans and animals, for all of us. Many people, you know, are animal lovers. We don't want to see animals being abused and suffering and, you know, with good reason. So absolutely, it affects us all.
And so I love that you say that, because one of the great things I find about this topic is, so if you watch TV lately, you might say, like, okay, well, everyone on the right hates everyone on the left, and everyone on the left hates everyone on the right. And this is one topic that I find Democrats, independents, and Republicans, they all agree. Nobody wants to see cruelty to animals. And when people know, they overwhelmingly vote to change animal laws. So if those animal laws can get to the ballot, if they can get through the legislature and actually get on the ballot, overwhelmingly, regardless of party, people choose to better standards for animals. So I think this is kind of a bright light in our current political situation.
Yeah, it's definitely a bipartisan issue. It affects us all, with whether it's via our own health, our human health, or whether we're subjecting, you know, these workers to these awful conditions, or, you know, whether it's via the animals or our environmental impacts. So absolutely. I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, and I didn't think it was possible. I have to say the truth. I didn't think that Republicans and Democrats could agree on anything. But here they're, in fact, I think I was watching Fox and I saw Tucker Carlson on Fox, and he was saying how much he was against factory farms and how he didn't like to see cruelty of any kind, and he's very much to the right. And you might think, oh, well, this is very much a leftist position, but he was very much against any cruelty to animals. And so I think it's just heartwarming, actually, to see both sides come together.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I absolutely agree, because this is ultimately an issue that we're dealing with now and we're going to continue to have to deal with in the future. So we absolutely need everyone behind it and on board.
So what is the cultural zeitgeist now in the United States? Are you seeing any change towards this subject, or where are we going here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I get to maybe stop being the negative sort of loom now, and I can focus on some positive things. So we are already seeing industry changing. So you know, plant-based milks, for instance, are skyrocketing.
13% of the market, which is an amazing figure. 13% of all milks sold are plant-based milks.
Yes, and even veggie burgers. There are burgers that are supposed to, you know, taste, look, feel like meat burgers, are outselling beef burgers at certain restaurants and certain stores and such. So that's pretty exciting. And if, you know, for meat lovers, it's sort of a fun thing to try. The Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat are awesome alternatives to a beef burger without, obviously, all of the negative repercussions we were talking about. But yeah, our industry is changing, and we even see the meat and dairy industry, the companies, corporations investing in plant-based products because they see that this is where the money's going, and they're like, hey, I want in.
No, I think you're absolutely right. So I look at Tyson, who's changed its name from being a meat company to a protein company. So Tyson has recognized, like, okay, people care about protein. You can get protein from plants or you can get it from animals. we really don't care. We'll make money either way. So they've changed their name from being a meat company to a protein company. And I think that's fascinating. And I commend them for that, for just being great entrepreneurs, basically, for saying, like, I don't care where it comes from. I'm here to make money. And if plant protein does the job, I'm all for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know I equate, and many people equate, animal protein with protein. I mean, animal products is the only way we can get protein, but that's a myth. That's definitely not true. We can get all our essential amino acids that our body needs, all the complete protein from plant-based sources. And yeah, absolutely. So Tyson actually invested, I believe it was $150 million into a fund for plant-based foods, including an awesome initiative called Clean Meat, which I don't know if I have time to get into now, but this is a really cool scientific initiative if anyone's interested in technology or science that's happening right now.
Yeah, so let's talk about technology when we come back. And I also want to talk about my favorite snacks and some awesome food ideas. But yeah, let's talk about technology when we come back from break, because that's a whole nother area that I think is so exciting to see all that we're doing in new technology and food. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get down? This is my favorite song of all time. I'm not kidding, Kasera really's got my number. So my producer in the box tonight is Kasera, and clearly she's a DJ. These are the best jams ever.
Thank you.
Okay, she's awesome. We're coming back to her in just a second. So we left before the break. We were talking about technology. So I think this is so fascinating. When you think, you know, we're so technology forward, you think how our lives have changed so much. I mean, who has a landline? Who even has, well, my mother. But other than that, who has a landline? I mean, you think nobody even hails a taxi anymore. You get on your phone, you go to Uber, that goes to a satellite, then you get a car. But our food supply system is like way back in the dark ages still. Nothing has really changed there until we got to clean meat. So Stephanie, fill me in. What is clean meat?
Yeah, so clean meat is an awesome scientific initiative being led right now by a few companies. And actually, it's the process of taking stem cells from animals without harming them and using those cells, cultivating them, replicating them in a lab setting, and essentially producing meat. So you might think, what is this? This is weird. This sounds really weird. Lab-grown meat. But it's not as weird as it sounds. So it is identical to the meat that we get from farmed animals because it's literally coming from their cells. And you know, it's clean meat because it comes without all these greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to climate change and all these health issues like antibiotics or hormones being in our meat. And, you know, obviously also helps the animals, and because the animals, you know, we don't need the animals essentially anymore. So, like I said, companies are working on this initiative. You can actually see a timeline of this progression where the meatballs, you know, they tried out a meatball and certain things like that. And the meat is there. The technology is viable. They're really just trying to get the product down so it can be spread wide.
Yeah, so I love this. They're really trying to scale the product so that they can get a price that makes sense for people. But what I love about it is that there's no waste. So if you think that you grow all these grains, wheat and soy, and then you don't give the grains to people, you give those grains to animals, and then the animals only give you about 30% back because you're not eating the tail or the hooves or the blood or the bones or the eyes or the heads or the ears. So it's not really an efficient equation. But with clean meat, you're growing exactly the meat you want, and you're only growing that. So you're not wasting anything, which means you can feed a lot more people. And I just think it's wonderful business. It makes so much sense for everybody on so many levels. And I think this is going to lead to a whole new set of jobs for farmers, either a lot more farmers farming vegetables or moving into other areas of the agricultural world. Because again, this whole conversation is about people as much as anything else. I mean, we care about the environment because we want people to survive. We care about people's health. And of course, we care about animals and we care about workers. So this is all about not one person is bad or one side has done the wrong thing. This is why I think Democrats and Republicans can agree. You know, no one's really pointing the finger like, ooh, you're bad and ooh, you're right. It's not that. It's just that come on now, it's no longer 1910, it's 2018. We can do better systems that make more sense for ourselves so that we can be healthier and, you know, not have as many environmental issues and waste issues, and we can do better. So it's just about, you know, giving all these people who are working now, having them work still. No, we don't want to put anyone out of work, but we're just trying to really shift the system a bit. Okay, so all this talk about basically saving the planet, I think, Stephanie, we've hit on everything today. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty, the really, really important topics. What's your favorite junk food?
Yeah, so there's this misconception that if you're vegan, you are extremely healthy and just have the perfect body type, and all of that they're just myths. So vegans, you don't have to be healthy, because nowadays there are actually a lot of vegan junk food and processed foods.
Doritos are vegan.
Yes, the purple bag. Yeah. Definitely. And vegan sweets, which I so love. And, you know, you don't have to compromise taste, which is wonderful. And I think an important part of the equation. So my vegan junk food that is my favorite, I would probably say, is like vegan chocolate cake.
Frosting. Yeah, no, you got me. Yeah, you had me at chocolate cake. That's for sure. Okay, so what item are we always going to find in your fridge?
I do drink a decent amount of almond milk. Also fruit. I have a lot of fruit, as well as... I honestly do eat out a lot as well, especially in the Chicago area. There are just so many wonderful plant-based restaurants and cafes to go to. So it sort of depends on the week what's in the fridge, I suppose. But I would say probably a lot of fruit.
Oh, my God. You are reliable. Okay, I'm going to throw it to my DJ extraordinaire. Cassara, what are we always going to find in your fridge?
Oh, milk, because I'm a sucker for cereal in the morning.
Listen to you.
And turkey or ham. I like turkey and ham sandwiches.
Oh, yeah. Girl, have you not been listening to the conversation?
I have. I'm a meat lover. I'm sorry.
Well, so I want to see. We'll see. You know what? I'm going to talk to you in a month, and we'll see if there's any. Have you ever tried an alternative meat?
The one time I did, I got food poisoning.
No way.
I haven't done it since. Had a bad experience.
I think that's too funny. Have you tried the Beyond Meat Burger?
No, I have not.
Ooh, have you heard about it?
I have.
Yeah. And do people, you've heard like good things probably.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about it. I just have a fear ever since my one bad experience a couple years ago in college. So.
Yeah, no, that'll be back in the day. Okay, so both of you have very descriptive things in your fridge. Mine's Tabasco. I'm sorry. It's just like, I can't do anything without spices. Mine's always Tabasco.
I like my sriracha too.
Yes. Fair enough. And is there one go-to meal, Stephanie? Like, there's one thing you can walk in, you only have 5 minutes, but you know you can whip it up and it's always going to be good.
Yeah, I like tofu and tempeh a lot. So that is super easy you could bake it or grill it. And my dad actually makes a lot of food with me. So he'll, you know, throw it in a pan and put whatever sauce you want, peanut sauce, soy sauce, a bunch of veggies, and you can make a taco out of it, tortillas and hot sauce and such, rice and beans. The rice and beans are actually a complete protein, a little fun fact. And, or, you know, you could make a sandwich out of it. So I think that's a really easy thing to grab from the fridge. I know some of my other friends who are veg, what might have some of those meat-based alternatives that you were talking about. So Beyond Meat, they've come out with awesome burgers and sausages even now. Yeah. You can get the sausage at a place in Chicago, actually, where I was there and I had to try it. And the server actually told me that more non-veg people order that sausage because they just love it so much.
No, they
than
made
veg
it for
people.
Yeah, no, they made it for Cassara. Really, no, they had Cassara in mind when they made the Beyond Meat Burger. So next time I'm coming into the studio, I'm coming in with a Beyond Meat Burger for Cassara. So Cassara, if you walk in the door and you've got like 3 minutes before you go DJing, is there one meal you know how to make and you know it's always awesome?
Actually, no. I'm horrible to where I'm usually running very late with my DJ gigs, so I have to like use all of my time to put the music together. So I'll just grab something on the way that's really fast. Or I typically try to book gigs where I get like a bar tab with food, and then I'll eat there before I start spinning. And I don't know. My go-to is usually a burger with fries.
Okay, so if I get this right, you spin first, then you think about food. Is that what you're getting? Okay.
Yeah, for most part, yeah.
Okay, so you know how some people have like food quirks, like they don't want this food to touch that food on the plate and this can't touch that, and they've got like all these food rules for themselves? I have none of those. So I just like to take my favorite go-to meal when I walk through the door is what's there, first of all, because there may not be much in the fridge. So I just take whatever's left and I throw it together. And I don't care if it's like sweet and savory or spicy and salty, and I don't mind. It can all go. I make a bowl out of anything and I eat it. I realize that this is not what other people might have in mind, but I don't like to see food waste. So I'm always throwing together, you know, avocado and beans and onions and tomatoes and rice and tortillas and just, you know, whatever I've got going on. And then I throw it together and they're always super satisfying. And I like it because it's always a surprise. So I never really know how it's going to shake out.
Yeah, that's great, actually. I do that as well because I really don't like to waste food. And like you said, I mean, you can make a stir fry of anything you want. You throw anything you want in there. You could make, you know, a pineapple, cashew, tofu stir fry, or you could use, you know, beans and throw rice and all of these, your favorite veggies or your favorite fruits and all your spices and sauces. You just throw it up and put it in a frying pan. Super delicious.
Yes, I do a lot of cooking demonstrations on Facebook Live and on WCIU and other outlets. And I always like to tell people, you know, you don't have to follow a recipe. Not everything has to be measure this teaspoon and this has to be perfect. A lot of the fun of cooking is just to get used to being around the food. Chop it, touch it with your hands, throw it in, experiment. So this is the great thing about sauteing something up or doing a stir fry. It's anything goes. There's not like one recipe for a stir fry. It just kind of depends what you have in the fridge, what you're going to saute up, what you're going to throw in, and then it's anybody's guess how it's going to come out. But often it comes out really well, and it's just getting comfortable around food, I think, that is the big win towards cooking. A lot of people say, oh, I can't cook. Everybody can cook. It's just kind of getting over that initial hurdle of, you know, what am I going to do? And when you get past that, it all kind of comes together. I'm just going to go out with my DJ because she's been so fabulous today. I'm going out on your favorite junk food. Kassara, what's your favorite junk food?
Oh, my favorite junk food is, if I'm in the mood for like a sweet, I like Insomnia cookies.
Oh, yeah.
And if I want something to go along for like a barbecue, probably like chips.
Chips.
Or Cheetos. Ooh, Cheetos paws. Those are my go-to right now.
All right. So we all went to college together, apparently, because I lived on those things for 4 years straight. It's amazing I'm not pure orange at this moment. Kassara, I want to thank you for the jams because it was so super fun. And Stephanie, thank you for coming with me, being here tonight on Nightside and 720 WGN. If somebody wants to have you speak at their school or someone's interested, how can they find out more about FFAC?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And if you want to reach me, you can reach me at Stephanie, it's with a P-H and an I-E at the end, at FFACoalition.org. We're FFAC for short.
Wonderful. Thanks for being with me tonight. You've got your marching orders, folks. You know what to do. Have a great night.